Chapter 3. By the assistance of the dog, man was ennobled. Enabled. Enabled to hunt such animals as were necessary to preserve his own existence, and to destroy those which were no-shows and the greatest enemies of his race. Noxious. Very good. Buston, go on, please. Itali stood leaning his arms on the lectern, watching the three copies of Buffon pass from hand to hand, the 15 serious faces. The youngest pupil was 12. The eldest, Isabeau, the pupil teacher, was 16. As each boy read, Isabeau looked at him with fierce and pleading eyes. The bell of a nearby church struck noon. Little Paroi gabbled through his reading, and Itali dismissed them. As the others left, Isabeau came up to him.
Don't look so worried, Augustine. They're doing very well.
It's Vastan, sir. He won't apply himself. Itali watched the boy with patient affection, his long, thin throat, in which the Adam's apple bobbed up and down, as he spoke, his big red hands and clear eyes. Isabeau never laughed, and smiled only when he thought Itali wanted him to smile. Another teacher looked in. "Hold on, Brunoy. I'm coming," Itali said, and soon joined them. Poor Isabeau. What a conscience the boy has. Come on, I'm hungry. Oh, God, how am I coming to hate the noble Buffon, as translated by the noble Prudevin, as executed by aspiring youth? They left the gloomy halls of the derelict grain storehouse, now occupied by the Erinin School, where Itali had been employed as a teacher for 6 weeks. Someone at the Café Illyrica had mentioned the place. He'd investigated and found himself hired to teach reading, composition, history, 5 mornings a week, before he'd ever heard of the Lancaster system or Pestalozzi's works on education. Erinin, a philanthropical grain speculator, had founded the school. 50 boys, the son of day labourers and artisans, were enrolled in it, some paying a low tuition fee, some none. It was the only lay school in the city, where a poor man's son might learn to read and write. In hiring Itali, Erinin had given him a 3-hour lecture on education, but that was the last anyone had seen of him. The rumour was that he'd found a new hobby horse to ride. So far, by nagging Eronin's secretary, the three teachers had managed to draw their salary. But there was no money for books, chalk, coal, and so forth. Brunoy, who taught the younger boys, was philosophical. "It's lasted over a year," he said. "I never thought it would last so long." As they came out into the sweet air of the October noon, Brunoy coughed and laughed. "You like Isabeau, do you?"
"Of course."
"He worships you."
"Oh, that's his age. You have to make a hero out of somebody at 16.
If there's any purpose in this education business, it's enlarging their world enough so they can find proper heroes, real heroes, instead of makeshift and tinsel."
"Why shouldn't you be his hero?"
"Because my heroism consists first in my educated accent. He thinks it's educated. You think it's provincial. And second, in the fact that I stand 6 feet tall." "Discrimination," Itali said, waving his arm.
Discrimination is the purpose of education.
Brunoy smiled. They walked on a little way, and Itali broke out afresh.
I admire your patience so much, Egan. I get cross with them.
How do you stay patient?
I have nothing but patience to fill the gap between my old ideals and my actual achievement.
That gap between what we want to do and what we do. You call it patience. I call it waiting for God.
It's in that gap, that gulf, that creation occurs.
If I haven't the strength to wait, I leap in and try to play God and spoil everything.
11, Brunoy said, to a short, dark, spectacled man walking briskly past them.
13, Itali added.
The man nodded, said, 17, and went on past.
When he was around the corner, Itali released a stifled snort and said, "This life is crazy."
The short man in spectacles was the third teacher in the Erenin school, a mathematician who believed that the secret of human destiny was written code-like in the sequence of the prime numbers. An atheist, he was offended by Brunoy's and Itali's inert Catholicism, and did his best to convert them to the mystery of the primes. The salutation they had just exchanged gave him a good deal of pleasure.
"You don't belong in it," Brunoy said gently.
Brunoy was a thin, brown-haired man in his early 30s, with a look of ill health and a mild manner. At first, Itali had seen in him the signs of disillusion, enthusiasm soured, which he'd learned to expect from men of the generation before his, who had given themselves to hopeless efforts of reform or innovation in education, economics, or politics in the century's first two decades. Old liberals, old radicals, still haunting the Illyrica, still breaking out with gusts of defeated passion, honest, ineffectual ghosts. Very soon he realized that Brunoy was not this sort at all. A watchmaker's son, he had gone through the university on scholarship, unmarried, solitary, poor. Brunoy had not turned sour or cynical. He had merely accepted silence as his lot, silence until the end. Yet he had let Itali break that silence.
"Nor do you," Itali said, as they went into the workman's tavern where they took their midday dinner.
"All I ever wanted was to teach." Itali brought their mugs of beer to the table.
"Listen, you said you'd written something once, a theory of education."
Brunoy nodded.
"Can I see it?"
"I burned it."
"Burned it?"
Itali said, shocked. "Years ago. It was unpublishable. The censors would never have let it pass. And the ideas are mostly current now in other men's works."
You shouldn't have burned your ideas. Could you rewrite it?"
"No. The ideas are common now. And anyhow, why? There's nowhere to publish anything of that kind."
"Yes, there is. Will be."
Brunoy cocked his head. "I'm asking you for a contribution to the first issue of Novisma Verba." Still, Brunoy said nothing.
"How do you like the name?"
"The newest word."
"I like it very much.
But whose word?"
"Ours, me, Breleve, Frenin, you, the country, Europe, mankind."
"I'll tell you. The name is my idea. The others like it. It sounds right. But I tell you what it means to me. We have something to say, and we haven't said it yet. We stammer. We try to learn to speak like infants. We don't know how. We say a little of what we have to say sometimes, in different languages, in a painting, in a prayer, in an act of knowledge. Every so often, we learn a new bit of it, a new word. The newest word is the word freedom. Maybe it's no more than a new way of saying one of the old words. I don't think so. It's new. Still, we're a long way from being able to say the whole thing yet. But we must learn the new words, all of us. We must all be able to speak them. They're no good if you don't say them aloud. O Prometheus, Brunoy said very softly. All right. That's all my notions. The point is, it's now possible that we may actually publish this journal, and I'm asking you to contribute to the first number. Since the first number will very likely be the last, my request gains urgency. Brunoy raised his beer mug, gestured to Itali to do the same, and touched mugs in salute. To Novesma Verba, long life. They drained their mugs. So, said Itali, triumphant, setting down his mug. Brunoy shook his head. Why not, Egan? The older man looked down, was silent for a minute. Their food was served. Itali began to eat, shoveling it in, though he continued to watch Brunoy in puzzlement and hope. Brunoy looked at his plate, did not eat, and said finally, fear. I don't believe you. Oh, not fear of the censor. Fear of the police, if that was all I had to fear. He made some pretense of eating, set his fork down again. In order to do what you're doing, Itali, one must believe in it entirely, passionately. One must believe in the importance, the necessity of it. The belief is wealth, strength, health. I don't know that we're doing the right thing, Egan, or doing it the right way. I'm doing all I know how to do, all I can find to do. It may all be useless, worse than useless. You know it is not. I hope it is not. And you too. I do not hope. I do not have time for hope. I am a poorer man than you know, than you are able to know. You have no idea what poverty is, Itali. He spoke with open affection, tenderly, so that Itali, confused between what he said and how he said it, did not know what to reply. I gave up all I had, he said at last, painfully. You gave up all you could. It's not your fault you're rich. What I care about most in the world. It's no use talking about it here. I didn't know it myself until I gave it up. That's what's so stupid. I keep going ahead, working for the time to come. That's what I care about, you say. But what I know is that my home is behind me. I've lost it. Let it go. Your home. My home. No metaphor. I mean the land, the place, the house I was born in, the dirt, the stupid dirt. I am tied to that land like an ox tied to a stake. If you don't know where your home is, how shall you be a pilgrim? You're a hypocrite, Itali. You wouldn't trade your homesickness for all the freedom in the world. But I'm ashamed of it. Shame is the conscience of the rich. Oh, come on, Egan. Write for us. Brunoy coughed, smiled, shook his head. You're not afraid. But his friend only smiled, luminous, elusive. When he left Brunoy, Itali set off to see Breleve, going some blocks out of his way to walk through the Elena Prada. It was a sunny, hazy autumn day, the city grey and golden. Leaves drifted underfoot in the walks of the great park. Itali liked the chestnut alleys and long lawns of old Queen Helen's fields. But the new English addition, with ruins, grotto, and so-called waterfall struck him as contemptible. He thought of the caverns of Ivaldi, of a Malafrena, caves where sensation was drowned in the enormous, ceaseless thunder of an imprisoned stream plunging through darkness till it broke out torrential into sunlight and leaped to the lake 100 feet below. What price plaster grottos! He crossed the river on the old bridge and headed out towards the Boulevard Prussia. All this section of the Trastevere had been built up in the last 20 years. Long, straight streets of row houses, row after row after row. Because they were all alike, there seemed no reason for any one of them to be there. There also seemed no reason why they should ever cease. They might run on forever, house after house, row after row. But if one walked on far enough, they ceased, stopped being, and with them the city ceased to exist, giving place to a field of burdock and mullein and shards, a dirt road going nowhere, perhaps a decaying shack or warehouse, and the hazy eastern hills. Walking those long, dreary streets gave Vitali the feeling of being caught in a stupid dream, and as befitted the dream, when he got where he was going, Breleve was out. He left a note and started back. Crossing Old Bridge, he leaned a while on the parapet to watch the silky, bluish water running quietly to the south, reflecting the lindens of the Molson Boulevard on the west bank. At the end of the parapet stood a stone figure of St. Christopher, his large, stiff hand, with fingers all the same length, raised in benediction over all pilgrims and traffic of the bridge. River Quarter stank, shrieked, loomed, swarmed as ever. And in the doorway of 9 Mellenstrada sat the landlady, Mrs. Rosa, her seamed dark face glowering over the cat, one or another of all her mangy cats that sat in her lap. But she smiled tightly at Itali. She liked having a gentleman in her first floor back, though he paid no more rent than the weaver's family in the first floor front. When Frenin moved out, she'd divided the 4 rooms into 2 flats, which meant Itali had to go through his neighbor's rooms to reach his own, a small inconvenience for a 10 kroner rent. The weaver, Kune, was at his loom when Itali came through. He was at his loom 14 or 15 hours a day. He worked on the putting-out system. The factory issued him thread, he worked at home, and returned the cloth to the factory for finishing and cutting. A system very popular among owners, since the workmen competed in isolation instead of cooperating in union. The smell of dye, the rhythmic thump and rattle of the loom, were ground texture to all Itali's hours in his rooms. The loom filled half that bare room where he had first talked with Frenin. The family were thin, fair, white-faced people, cautious and wary in their ways, subdued. Itali could not get much response, even from the 5-year-old, and almost none from Kune. They were, he thought, afraid of him, afraid of everyone except one another. He slipped past the great complex loom, on which the white band of cloth grew relentlessly slow, faultlessly even, like some inhuman process of the world, the movement of the shadow on a dial, the progress of a glacier. Kune nodded. The baby was crying thinly in the other room. Itali sat down at his table to write, but his conversation with Brunoy and his fruitless errand into the Trastevere had left him depressed, and he lay down on the cot in the closet that served him as a bedroom, intending to read Montesquieu and forget his troubles. Within 10 minutes, he had forgotten them and Montesquieu as well. The book on his chest, his hands on the book, fast asleep. He was waked by a knock and staggered into the other room, which was full of hot red sunset light, expecting Brelave. He did not recognize the red-haired man in the doorway. Estenska, we met at the Puladeska's in August. It was Estenska, all right. The poet, the great poet. Itali stood staring, utterly floored. Sorry to disturb you, Estenska said in his high, hard voice. No, not at all. Please sit down. Not that chair. The back falls off. Estenska tested the back of Frenin's chair, found that it did indeed come off the seat, removed it, laid it aside, and sat down on the seat as on a stool. I came to make an apology, Mr. Sode. An apology? I had no right to be rude to you that night. Every right, Itali said, waving his hands. I'm sorry about it. It's absolutely unnecessary, Mr. S. Itali's throat dried up in the middle of the name. No, it was necessary, if I wanted to talk to you again. And Estenska smiled a brief, unjoyful, youthful smile. There are a lot of stupid people at the Palodeskas. I've got into the habit of being rude to them, since they expect it of me. But to be rude to you was a mistake, and I knew it at the time. Are you really trying to found a review, a journal? Yes. Please, this chair's all right. I like this one. How far have you got? Enough money for a couple of issues and enough promise for several more. A printer who knows what he's in for. A letter from Stefan Aragon in Rakava. That could be more of a liability than an asset. If the estates meet, it could be a real asset. What about the censor? My friend Brelave thinks he's getting somewhere with the man you mentioned, Goyne. Estenska gave his short, artificial-sounding laugh. How many of you are there? 4 of us from Solaryi, 6 or 7 from Krasnoy now. Jivan Karante is one of them. Perhaps you know him. Yes, a splendid talent and a good man, virtuous. Jivan Karante is a virtuous man. You're lucky to have him. Is it to be a literary journal, then? At first, the Bureau seems more approachable if we keep to literature. Yes, Estenska said harshly, but with real amusement. You can always get around them in the long run, because they don't really believe words can do anything. They don't really listen to Metternich. He knows better. If Metternich could have his heart's desire, every poet in the Empire would be locked up in the Spielberg prison for the rest of his life. I admire Metternich. He's an enemy, an equal. He has the wits and the enlightenment to fear the power of ideas, the power of the word. He's of the breed of 89, not one of those nouveaux, these Gentzes with their turncoat opportunism and illiterate mysticism, these worthy servants of the Habsburg, Bourbon, Romanov cretins, who wouldn't recognize an idea if it was pointing a gun at their empty heads. Thank God Metternich is off in Vienna, and all we have to fight here is 19th-century stupidity, not 18th-century intelligence. All barriers fell under that onslaught. We're calling it Novesma Verba, Itali said. And they were off, interrupting each other, excited, ardent, gesticulating, pacing, while the red light flared and sank in the room, and the loom rattled next door, and the bells of St. Stephen's, the university chapel, and the cathedral struck 6, and all the quarters and then 7. And the roofs and chimney pots across the courtyard dimmed in the brown autumnal dusk and grew dark and hard against the sky. Itali thought to light a candle at last. As he stood by the table, tinder box in hand, making sure the wick had caught, he looked up, and in the smoky light, his eyes and Estenska's met. "You see why I had to come," the poet said. "I'm glad you did," Itali said in his quiet voice. "I recognized you that night." Estenska continued to watch Itali with his peculiar yellowish, immobile gaze. "I don't know if you know what I mean by that. One comes to certain places, certain persons, to which one must come. To fail to recognize them, to turn aside from them, is to fail one's destiny. Do you know what I mean?" "I think so." "But one's destiny isn't always good, you know. I think you haven't considered that yet. Are you Catholic?" "Yes, as I eat with a knife and fork and wear a hat instead of feathers." "So was I. I took off the hat." "Forms are unimportant," Itali said broadly. "Not to a poet. But never mind. I want to tell you about myself, Sorde." He spoke with intensity, turning away from the light of the candle. Then his voice hardened as he said, "I suppose you know all about it from the Palodeskas." "I've never been back there." "Oh, you haven't? Louisa has spoken of you several times. I thought you went there often. But I'm surprised they said nothing that evening. Discretion's not their virtue. They love gossip. The more sordid, the better. The stupider, the better. Love affairs, they're called. The old word for it is adultery. If you know me, you'll know this. I'd rather tell you myself. 2 years ago, I performed the action known as falling in love. I became a lover. The object of my love is a married woman, who is rather stupid, very greedy, very cruel, not particularly beautiful. As soon as I saw her, she slipped her hands under my skin and took hold of me on the raw flesh and nerve, and I've been her puppet ever since. I dance when she raises her finger. I am her possession. If she called for me now, I would crawl to her house on all fours. I have stood on the doorstep and begged the footman to let me in. I've gone to her husband and asked him in tears. Excuse me, Sorde. I'm going. Not fit." He had stood up, neat and abrupt in his well-cut coat and fine linen. His voice still clear, and was blundering towards the door. Itali, with no consideration of his act, blocked his way. "You can't go now," he said fiercely. Estenska felt for the backless chair, sat down, sat hunched up for a minute, crying. He got out his pocket handkerchief and wiped his eyes and nose. "No good," he said, in a soft, boyish voice. And then, shoving back his red hair and speaking in his usual tone, or very near it, "What's your name?" "Itali. Amadei. What sort of cheese is that?" "Portachica." "Did you bring it with you?" "It was about a yard across. My aunt sent it. God knows how she bribed the carrier. He brought it to the door here. Are you hungry?" They were soon sitting at the table, the huge cheese, looking more prosperous in its blue coat than its owner did in his, sat between them, with a knife, a half loaf, and a jug of rather stale water. There was one plate. "I don't do a great deal of entertaining," Itali observed. "I like to keep to the old country ways, you know. Nothing ostentatious, no plates, no forks, no manners." "An aunt sent you this," you said. What other family have you got up there? Aunt and uncle, sister, parents. Hardly counts as a family in the Montana. More than I have. One brother. Never leaves the estate. You're the heir, then. You left something to come here. It seemed the thing to do. The thing to do. Estenska looked at Itali, at the cheese, at the candle flame. How easily you say that. I can guess pretty well at how much you had to give to earn the right to say it. To do the thing one has to do, that's the way. The right road, of course. And I've lost it. But you're writing. I haven't written a word for months. Of course, that's my road. But when it leads to a wall, or a hole in the ground, the end. You can't start a book with the end, can you? He spoke without excitement, and went on munching his bread and cheese contentedly. This is first-rate cheese, he said. There was a knocking on the hall door, the sound of voices in the weaver's room, a rap on Itali's door, and in burst Releve. He now sported a brocade vest and silk hat, but looked just as he had looked in college, thin, buoyant, and ironic. Victory! Triumph! He proclaimed, and then noticed the stranger. Oh, sorry, am I in the way? No, of course not. Thomas Releve, Amadei Estenska. What's up? Do you want some cheese? Very honored indeed, Mr. Estenska, said Releve, taken aback and so looking ironic to the point of being diabolical. This is a real privilege. No, I don't want any cheese, for God's sake. This is no time for cheese. What is it for? Go on with your cheese. Please don't let me disturb you. Will this chair hold together if I sit down carefully? I've got the trick one, Estenska said, still munching. Did you talk with Goyne? I did. Late this afternoon. I don't want to hear any more talk about old Releve. He's a jolly sort, but he never does anything. I know the kind of talk that goes on amongst these damned seditious radical groups, especially since you haven't got the manners to wait until my back's turned. Do you want to hear what I said to Goyne, and then what Goyne said to me, and then what I said to Goyne, with infinite tact and diplomacy, und so weiter, und so weiter, or shall I? Come on, Thomas. Entire sanction and license for the publication of... No. By God. You've got it, Itali shouted, jumping up. And Releve, only less excited because he was so pleased with himself, said, Let me tell you all about it, will you? They continued to talk, more or less simultaneously, for some while. Amadei Estenska watched them. He was envious of their old friendship, envious of their jubilation, and dubious of it. What did it amount to? This little crack in the immense wall of indifference, this glimmer in the dead, endless night of intellect. And yet, this was what he'd come here for, driven exactly this hope. And it caught at him as he watched them, so that exultation began to grow in him and brought him, too, to his feet. Come on, he said. Where do you fellows meet? The Illyrica? This course for the open air? Exactly. Come on, Itali. All right, I'm coming. Just let me get my hat. They ran down the back stairs, out of the house, into the streets full of early night, and a gusty, dry, autumnal wind blowing from the east. Come on, Itali urged, when the others slowed their pace in the pressure of talk. And he went ahead, full of that same exultation and certainty, letting the dark wind of October blow by him, and singing out loud the band hymn, Beyond this darkness is the light, O liberty of thine eternal day. So that passing whores and locked-out children
turned and laughed, or looked at him.